So, without further ado, today's talk is called Hypercasting. Part one, the story so far. Everything is changing. Everything has changed. Everything always changes. But at times, this change is particularly pronounced and thus specifically noteworthy. For media, which is the topic du jour, this is so plainly obvious that any attempt to refer to a before time has an almost archaeological feel, as though we were shoveling carefully through layers of dirt to find out how media worked just a few years ago. These transformations have been seismic and singular. There's no going back. But what exactly has happened? The revolution we glimpsed in 1994, when that rough beast of the web, its hour come at last, made the earth tremble, seducing and subsuming us into its ever-broadening expanse, that fell back for a while into patterns more established and more familiar. We glimpsed a utopia, then a fog rose and the vision faded. We endured half a decade of cupidity, stupidity, and the slow strangulation of our dreams. We longed for communion. We got DVD players delivered in under an hour. Fortunately, the network accelerates everything it embraces, and what might have taken just an entire generation just a few years ago took 5 years to run its course, from Netscape to Razorfish. And the lunar crater of NASDAQ seemed to spell the final doom of all our hopes. The web, people loudly proclaimed, was so over. Silly humans. During those first 5 years, we learned just how different network economics could be, not just in theory, but in practice. We learned that the essence of the digital artifact is that it exists to be copied. Like a gene in the Cambrian seas of the early web, information was copied and recopied endlessly. John Perry Barlow's Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace was one of the first such objects, spread via email and website until it became nearly impossible to ignore. More recently, Cory Doctorow's lecture on DRM from Microsoft Research, which is available online in text, or Pig Latin, or video, it's been passed around like a cheap $2, well, you know. Each of these individual artifacts eventually reached nearly every single individual who might find them interesting, because as they were copied and read and forwarded and linked to, each of the human nodes in this network made a decision that this information was important enough to share. In the networked era, salience is the only significant quality of information. For that reason, it was only a matter of time until the technologies of the network would reinforce this natural tendency and accelerate it. So even as the web died, it was reborn. The top-down design of 100 centralized sources of information evolved into 700 million peers, from each according to their ability and to each according to their need. Feeds replaced websites and torrents replaced streams. The revolution we had fleetingly glimpsed had finally, blessedly arrived. But one man's blessing is another's curse. The network revolution presented incredible opportunities to anyone working in the media industries. Suddenly it became possible to reach massive audiences, unbounded by proximity. But instead of reinforcing the previous structures of media ownership and information distribution, the network has consistently undermined them. Mention Craigslist to a newspaper man, and watch as the color drains from their face. Casually drop BitTorrent into a conversation with a studio executive and observe as they choke back their rage. The network carries within it the seeds of their own destruction, and they're absolutely, utterly, completely powerless to stop it. Now that would be a sad story if the professional media had not willingly cooperated in their own demise. The technologies of the digital era were simply too tempting to be ignored, too important to the bottom line. But the network has its own economics, and it quickly overcomes or blithely ignores any attempt to subvert its innate qualities. Film studios make the majority of their revenue from DVD distribution of their productions. But that same DVD, because of its essentially digital nature, can be copied and recopied endlessly at no cost. If it is salient, it will be copied widely. That's not just a horror story, that's the law. And if you don't want your film copied, well then, you'd have to resort to antique production technique. Make sure it's shot to film stock, physically edited, and good luck finding an editor who's happier on a Steenbeck than an Avid, and graded with no digital intermediates, then projected into an exhibition space where every audience member has been subjected to a humiliating physical search of their bodies. Well, you'd probably kill piracy if you did that, but you'd kill your exhibition revenues, and the studios, and the record companies, and the broadcasters, and the book publishers, they want to have it both ways. They want the benefits of digital distribution, all the while denying the essential quality of the medium, that it exists to be copied. But all of this noise about the approaching end of copyright obscures a more salient point. The barriers to distribution have utterly collapsed. Anyone can send anything to everyone, anywhere, at no cost. The tribulations of the professional media producers are simply the canary in the coal mine. They're the most sensitive to the economics of a distribution which has kept them well-fed for 100 years. Now those economics have irrevocably changed, and the entire business of professional media production is threatened. Part 2. Stupid is the New Black. Behold, I bring tidings of the second dot-com boom. Stupid is back! That, at least, is the message from 100 Insta-pundits on the business pages of newspapers, in blogs, and countless analyst reports. The entire world seems shocked by the entirely expected purchase of the video sharing site YouTube by Google for $1.65 billion U.S. dollars. It's a bad deal, some say, doomed to fail. It isn't worth it. It'll bring Google crashing back to earth with endless litigation from copyright holders who have just been waiting for someone with deep enough pockets to sue. Theh. What most everyone overlooked, as it happened the very same day as the Google purchase, were the licensing deals that YouTube struck with Universal, Sony, BMG, and CBS. Together with an earlier deal with Warner Music, YouTube now has a deal with every major music publisher in the world. YouTube will now figure out how to share all of that revenue it'll be generating with Google's advertising techniques to all of the copyright holders with materials who end up on YouTube. Now, some pundits have indicated that only a moron would buy YouTube, because it's widely believed that YouTube has built its business entirely on violations of copyright. Now, certainly, YouTube established its reputation with a specific piece of video owned by somebody else, a digital short from NBC's Saturday Night Live program, Chronic Sunday. That video, which was viewed millions of times before NBC rattled its legal saber and had it taken down from the site, introduced most users to YouTube. In the years since Chronic Sunday, YouTube has become a clearinghouse for the funniest bits of video produced by other companies, from segments of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, to South Park, to Family Guy, to The Simpsons. Why has YouTube become the redistributor of these clips? Because none of the copyright holders made an effort to distribute these clips themselves. YouTube has been acting as an arbitrageur of media, equalizing an inequity in the marketplace and getting very rich in the process. It may be copyright violation, but the power of the audience is far, far, far greater than the power of the copyright holder. YouTube could possibly delete every clip uploaded in violation of copyright, and to some degree they will do that. But if you have a few thousand people uploading the same clip, how do you stay ahead of that? Even YouTube itself is subject to the power of its audience. And if they become draconian in their enforcement of copyright, which is a possible outcome of the YouTube purchase, they will simply force the audience elsewhere, to other sites. Better by far to strike a deal with the copyright holders. so that they can receive a recompense for their efforts. Now, NBC has started to distribute Saturday Night Live's digital shorts on its own website. ABC and Fox offer full streaming versions of their TV shows, and everyone is queuing up to sell their wares on iTunes. Is this a willing transition? Probably not. Minutes spent in front of the computer are minutes lost to television ratings. But if the copyright holders do not distribute their content as widely as possible, someone else will. YouTube has proven this point beyond all argument. Now, some pundits believe that YouTube will die without a steady stream of content uploaded in violation of copyright. But if recent history is any guide, the studios are now falling over each other in their eagerness to do a deal and share some of that money. The simultaneity of the Google purchase of YouTube and the deals with the recording industry are not accidental. They're indicative of a great sea change. Big media has swallowed the bitter pill. They've realized that they've lost control of distribution. Now they're going to try and make some money off of it. But the pundits make another and a more damning point. They say that no one wants to watch those little handmade videos which make up the vast majority of uploads to YouTube. This is the big lie of big media. If it isn't professionally produced, the audience won't watch it. No statement could be more mendacious, and no statement could be further from the truth. As film producers and as broadcasters, some of these pundits certainly hope that the audiences prefer professional content to amateur productions, but there's no evidence to support this position, and quite a bit to counter it. The success of Red vs. Blue, Homestar Runner, Happy Tree Friends, and The Show with Zay Frank, each of which command audiences in the hundreds of thousands to millions, prove that audiences will find the content that interests them and share that content with their friends using the hyper-distribution techniques enabled by the network, which ensure that audiences get what they want from anyone, anywhere, at any time, with a minimum of difficulty. These productions lie completely outside the bounds of professional media. They are amateur, not in the sense of raw or poorly produced, but because they have turned their backs on the antique systems of distribution which previously separated the big boys from the wannabes. A perfect example of this transition can be seen in the video that you just watched by the Australian band Sick Puppies. Shot by the band's drummer, it features a well-known character, Juan Mann, who inhabits Sydney's Pitt Street Mall bearing a sign, "Free Hugs." The band befriended this unlikely character and shot hours of video of him at work giving free hugs to passers-by. While in Los Angeles pursuing a recording career, the drummer cut his footage into a 3-minute film and then added the band's song All the Same as a temp track. Thinking to share his work around, he uploaded the video to YouTube on September the 26th of this year and told his friends, who told their friends, who told their friends. YouTube is particularly good at the viral distribution of media. It's the one thing they've gotten absolutely right. So now, 3 weeks later, 3 million people have seen that video. The Sick Puppies are on the map. Their music video has given them a worldwide fan base, and a debut album on a major label expected early next year will complete their transformation from amateur to professional. Salience determines whether an audience will gather and share media, not production values. In the time before hyper-distribution, audiences had a severely limited pool of choices, all of them professionally produced. Now the gates have come down, and audiences are free to make their own choices. When placed head-to-head, can a professional production of modest salience stand up against an amateur production of great salience? Absolutely not. The audience will always select the production which speaks to them most directly. Media is a form of language, and we always favor our mother tongue. The future for YouTube lies with the amateurs, not with the professionals. The pundits miss the point entirely, assuming that the audience will behave as it always has. But this is not that audience. This is an audience which has essentially infinite choice and has come to understand that the sharing of media is an act of production in itself, that we are all our own broadcasters. And you'd have to be a moron to miss that. Part 3. The Epidemiology of Cool. We know why YouTube has had such an incredible string of successes. The site makes it very easy to share a video with your friends, and for your friends to share videos with their friends, and so on. The marketers call this viral distribution, but we know it by another and much more prosaic name, friendship. As an inherently social species, we are constantly reinforcing our social connections through communication. It could be an IM, a text message, an email, a phone call, or a video. It's all the same to the enormous section of our forebrains that we use to process the intricacies of our social relationships. We share things to tell our friends we're thinking of them, and, rather more competitively, to show our friends that we're on the tip. Each of us are cool finders. Now, some of us, like Corey, do it professionally, and we each keep a little internal thermometer which measures our own cool against our peers. That innate drive to be recognized for our tastes has been accelerated by the speed of light, by the network. And now, even as we cool find, we are constantly inundated and challenged by the cool finding of our peers. It's produced a very healthy, if ultra-Darwinian, ecology of cool. Our peers are the selection pressure as we struggle to pass our memes on to the next generation. Now, thus far, we've done this on our own with very little assistance from the wealth of computing machinery which crowds our lives. We create ad hoc solutions for media distribution, mailing lists, websites, podcasts, each of these an attempt to spread our ideas more successfully. But they're held together tenuously only by our constant activity, like bees maintaining the cells of a hive. And it's a lot of work. We're forced to do it. We're forced to run the race, lest we be overrun by the memes of others. But we've reached one practical limit. Time. No one has enough time in the day to keep up with all the information we should be absorbing. We can filter ruthlessly and perhaps miss out on something we'll regret later, or we can declare email bankruptcy like Lawrence Lessig, or just withdraw and withdraw and withdraw to an ever more specialized domain of cool finding. And we are doing each of these things every day under the pressure of all this information. There's got to be a better way. In the early years of the 19th century, farmers in western Pennsylvania kept their wagon wheels greased with puddles of bubbling muck that studded the countryside. Although useful, the puddles were a toxic nuisance to livestock. If the farmers could have rid their lands of these puddles, they would have. But a half a century later, western Pennsylvania became a boomtown, building on its substantial petroleum reserves. That bubbling muck had immense value, but it had to wait for the demands of the kerosene lamp and the internal combustion engine. In the early years of the 21st century, we each generate an enormous amount of interaction data. Each click on a computer, every email sent or received, every website visited, every text message, every phone call, every swipe of a credit card or loyalty card or debit card, every face-to-face interaction. None of it is recorded, at least none of it's recorded by us for any of us, although obviously the NSA has expressed some interest in it, because it hasn't been seen as valuable. It's bubbling up through all of us and around all of us, as we create data shadows that have grown greater and longer and now resemble Jacob Marley's lock boxes and chains rattling around the corridors of cyberspace. All of that information is worth more than oil. It's worth more than gold. And all of it is, sadly, almost obscenely dropped on the floor as soon as it's created. If we're lucky, it's deleted. If we're unlucky, someone uses it to create a digital simulacrum, and we find our identities hijacked. But in no case is this information ever exposed to us for our own use. We're told it has no value, and so far we've been stupid enough to believe it. But now, just now, economic forces are linking the persistence of our data shadows to our ability to filter the avalanche of information which characterizes life in the 21st century. It turns out that this data guck, is good for greasing more than the wheels of cyberspace. These data shadows glow with the evanescent echo of our real social networks. Not the baby steps of MySpace and Friendster, but the real ground truth interactions which reveal ourselves and our relations one to another. It is human metadata, and it's the most valuable thing we've got now that there's a demand for it. Now, YouTube records every email address you use to forward a video to a friend. It uses these at present to do auto-completion of addresses as you type them in. It presents a friendly list of these addresses to make forwarding all that much easier. What they're not doing, at least not visibly, and I've had a good look at the YouTube website, and quite likely they're not doing it at all, is they're not keeping any record of what I sent to whom, nor when, nor why. Yet every video forwarded through YouTube is forwarded for a reason. Salience. YouTube could record these moments of salience, could use them to build a model, a data shadow, which would reinforce your own ability to decide who should see what. It might even, to some degree, automate these processes. And when you add this to the newly emerging ideas of analytic folksonomy, where you compare one user's tag clouds to another user's tag clouds within a social network, certain relationships and affinities emerge. Again, these relationships can be used to improve the capability of these systems to help you find, filter, and forward the relevant videos. This is how a social network will really work. It's not about having 500 first-degree connections in MySpace. It's about listening to your naturally occurring social network to direct, improve, and accelerate your information flow. When the brand new power of the broadcaster is reified by the capabilities of computing machinery to listen and model our interactions, the result is hypercasting. This is what media in the 21st century is hurtling toward, driven by the natural selection of steadily increasing informational pressure. Hypercasting solves some lingering questions confronting us. The first and most important of these is this: how will we figure out what to watch when we've got a near infinite set of choices? We'll rely on the recommendations of our friends, as we always have, but now these recommendations will be backed up by a hypercasting system which will invisibly and pervasively keep track of our interests. The points of interest we hold with our friends, the points of interest we hold with our communities, our co-workers. It will not be automatic. No one really wants to see some out-of-control hypercasting system deluge us with video spam. But it will be so tightly integrated into our interactive experiences that it will barely register on our perceptions. We'll simply come to expect that our iPods, our media centers, our PSPs, and our mobiles are loaded up and ready for us. Addiction to television will soar to new levels. A new crop of amateurs, millions of them, will find successful and lucrative careers in media production, and advertisers, as always, will find new ways to spread their messages. On the surface, things will look a lot as they do now, but everything will move at a very rapid clip. Videos will fly across the world in seconds, not days, and global audiences will gather in moments. almost accidentally, this will change news reporting forever. As citizen journalism finally becomes a real threat to established journalists and their utter undoing. Shouldn't the New York Times be subject to the same selection pressures which today afflict News Corporation? So is YouTube the harbinger of the transition to hypercasting? The lead is theirs to lose. GooTube delivers over half of all the videos seen on the internet. They have the cash and the brain power to transform broadcasting into hypercasting. And they have to worry about the next set of 20-somethings in a garage working on the next big thing. Those kids who have been nurtured by YouTube know just what's wrong with it, and they'll know how to make it better. YouTube faces its own selection pressures, which will only increase as it grows exponentially and cuts content deals and tries to keep the whole centralized mess up and running. Yet it doesn't matter. We have seen birth and death, and we thought they were different, but the death of the web brought a new kind of life, a vitality and sure-footedness suppressed during the years of MBAs and crazy business plans and IPOs. Perhaps history is repeating itself as everyone goes wild again with another case of gold fever and will lose the plot. In that case, we should be glad of another death. Hypercasting might need to wait for a few years for a platform very much like a fully mature Democracy DTV or something we haven't yet dreamt up. It may be that YouTube will disappoint, but that doesn't mean anything at all. YouTube isn't driving the audience toward hypercasting. The audience is. And the audience, in its teeming, active, probing billions, gets whatever it wants. That's the first rule of show business.